Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 28, Language Arts, Part 1, Watch Your Language. There are, among others, two exceptional individuals who travel around to Waldorf schools, one on the West Coast, that's Helen Lubin, and another in the East Coast, Michael Steinruck. And they work with the teachers on Sprachgestaltung, better known in English as speech formation. Sometimes they'll work with groups of students as well. And speech formation is, of course, an art like eurythmy, developed by Rudolf Steiner, in fact, developed at about the same time, in which speech becomes ensouled, even to some extent spiritualized. And one can often tell in an experienced Waldorf teacher the kind of work that they've done over the years. You hear the clarity of their speech, the resonance, the beauty of it. It's a wonderful thing that they are able to go around and do that in schools that can afford them, are blessed. It's interesting that there's no one going around and working with teachers on grammar in much the same way. Now, I'm not volunteering to do that. I have a few friends still in the Waldorf movement. I don't want to lose them, because it's very interesting that though people find speech formation difficult, especially when they do it individually, sometimes quite frustrating, even to the point of tears, to get that speech just right, to realize how fixed and hardened their larynx is and how unresponsive their tongue and lips and teeth are, still nothing comes close to hurting people's feelings and making them feel defensive than pointing out a grammatical error, particularly when it's a recurrent grammatical error. And so very often, in faculty meetings, in everyday conversation, teachers become tolerant, we could say, of one another's grammatical failings, or perhaps they just ignore them or figure, oh, I'm not going to go through that one again. And in fact, it's reached a point where people don't even notice one another's failings because they're speaking in exactly the same way. It's something that has slowly, slowly unfolded in the Waldorf movement to the point where in many schools that I visit, I just hear all day long grammatical errors on the part of teachers and see no one around to correct them. Now, when teachers are teaching grammar lessons, that's a different matter. They have the rules written out. They basically know what they're doing. But that's just a small part of the grammar teaching that we're doing. A much greater part is played by our speech, by what we're saying to students, and no less importantly, when we correct students, when we catch their own grammatical errors and bring them to mind. Now, we can't be doing that all the time with every student in the class. I think we have to set certain limits so that perhaps at snack time they can go back and speak in the American vernacular to one another, to speak in the particular language which is ceaselessly changing, that pubescent and teenage children use with one another. But as long as class is in session, from the moment the verse is spoken until the time snack has been blessed or sanctified in some way or another, when students get up to speak, when they raise their hands to answer a question, in that time, we have to be very strict, draconian, in our ceaseless crusade against poor speech and poor grammar. And students will be grateful for the help that we give them. as time goes on, when they realize that in a business meeting, even in college, they may be the only ones who know how to speak English correctly. But that has to come first and foremost from you, the teacher. So hurtful though it may be, you have to listen to yourself, perhaps even record a main lesson. You'll hear four excerpts from main lessons that I do in teaching Christianity as History in this conference, and you can subject me to as much critical examination as you wish on that. I can't say my grammar is perfect throughout, but you have to do something similar to yourself and listen and see what grammatical tics you may have, what common errors you make. So we could say, I think, that speech formation is the soul, to some degree, the spirit of speech, but primarily the soul of speech. It's really working on the muscles of language, even the cartilage when it affects the larynx. But grammar is the skeleton of speech. Grammar moves from soul to spirit. And Steiner speaks in grade 6 of the importance of the plasticity of language, particularly in relationship to the subjunctive mood of a sentence. We'll look at that later on. But right now, I want to share with you, as we approach the skeletal part of the student's education, some of the very common errors that I hear in teacher speech, and just ask you to be awake to them and perhaps go to a grammar book and see what you can do to learn more about why these mistakes are so common. Although I'm not listing these in any particular order, I think you'll see that the first one I bring up is extremely common. And this has to do with that irregular verb, which is so commonly used and so often misused. And this is the word lie and lay. So the verb lie, as in to lie down, is conjugated like this: lie, lay, and lain. So we could say, today Thomas lies on the couch, yesterday he lay on the couch, and before that he had lain on the couch. So those are the three proper forms of the verb to lie. And the confusion is, of course, with the past tense lay being the same as another verb. So it's lie, yesterday to lay, and long before that had lain. That's something that you simply have to practice again and again, because it is confused everywhere and by everyone. And of course, we are often telling the students, put your books down on your desk, put down your pencils. You may want to say, what? Lay down your pencil. So let's look at lay, as in lay down a pencil or to lay an egg. Its conjugation is like this: lay, laid, and laid. So laid repeats twice there. Today, Thomas lays his shoes to rest. Yesterday, he laid them to rest. And before that, he had laid them to rest. Lay, laid, and laid. Once again, not used that often. How often do people say had laid anymore? How often do they speak in a perfect tense anymore altogether? We'll go into that. But please work on this Besides the different ways in which lie and lay are conjugated, there's also a grammatical difference which can help. Lie cannot be followed immediately by any noun or pronoun, whereas lay must be followed immediately by a noun or pronoun. So that can help you. We do not lie something down. We don't say, lie your pencils down or lie down your main lesson books. We understand that. So that helps on the one hand. We do not lie something down. We lay something down. Because lay must be followed immediately by a noun or pronoun. And we do not lay down in the present tense. We lie down. Because lie cannot be followed immediately by any noun or pronoun. It can, however, be followed by an adverb. So, if you're referring to putting your own body on a couch or a bed, you need lie, lay, lain. If you're referring to putting another entity somewhere, you need lay, laid, and laid. Okay? Work on that one, because it's subtle, but it's very important. And it really helps the children think about whether they are doing something to themselves, moving themselves, or moving something outside of themselves. It's of psychological value. It really helps that astral body know whether it's inside or outside. And this is one of the reasons why these two verbs are so commonly mistaken for one another, why they're tend to be, lay tends to be the one that's overused, because we are increasingly experiencing ourselves, talking about ourselves as an object. We'll see how often this comes up in grammatical issues. It has a great deal to do with self-image, more than a lot of programs that try to improve a child's self-image or self-esteem. Remember those days, self-esteem? Grammar can really help there. It helps us recognize that we are mostly subjects and rarely objects. Now, there are another two verbs that come up in class, especially this first one, as you'll see. The conjugation of the verb to drink. Drink, drank, drunk. So another way of saying it is, today Sarah drinks tea. Yesterday she drank tea. Before that she had drunk tea. Now, people don't use the word drunk very much except as an adjective describing someone else or a noun, he is a drunk. It tends to be used by uneducated people instead of drank. You know, I drunk a lot. But it's in the perfect tense. Drinks tea, drank tea, and had drunk tea. So, drunk refers to alcohol when it shows up after am, is, are, was, were. But after has or have, drunk simply indicates that something took place long ago. Same thing with shrink, shrank, and shrunk. In spite of that movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, it should be Honey, I Have Shrunk the Kids, or Honey, I Had Shrunk the Kids. But otherwise, we say that the shirt shrank. My handwork shrank when I accidentally put it through the hot water cycle or something like that. So please be aware in particular of the difference between lie and lay, and secondly, drink, drank, and drunk. Be sure that you provide a proper example for your students when you use those verbs. We'll go on in the next section to look at some other common errors, and this will help us segue to what we're going to be doing with the students this year as well.